Yeah, I think most everybody's here, so let's go ahead and get started. First of all, any problems with anyone accessing website, getting hold of a textbook to look at? Everything okay as far as that goes? Anyone try the reserve room at the library, the two-hour reserve? No? I know some of you bought the or got a hold of the fifth edition, and I mentioned that one would work. There's a few things that have changed with the between editions, but if that's the case, let me know, and I do have an assignment list or the page assignments for the fifth edition for you to use if you need to get hold of that. So I want to tell you a little bit about what we're going to do in here this week, and we're going to start talking about soil morphology, and that's going to be really the focus of the first couple of weeks. So we will have lab on Thursday afternoon, and we'll meet right down the hall on the right in room 133. And what we will be doing is giving you a chance to get some hands-on experience looking at and feeling some of the things that we're going to be talking about in here related to soil morphology. And for some of you, this is going to be review. It'll be something you've already had, and that's fine. It'll just hopefully reinforce it. And for some of you, it's probably going to be new. So what I like to do is leave it up to you to decide how much time you need to spend looking in lab. I don't really set it up so that there's something to turn in per se, but it's designed just to be self-paced. You stay as long as you feel like you need to get a good handle on the material. So for some of you, that probably won't be maybe more than an hour or a little bit more. Some of you, probably a couple hours. Okay? And I think what I'll try, at least for this week, is we'll just have everybody come at 1:30. And it might be a little busy in there, but we'll see how it goes. And if it seems like it's too many folks, then we'll maybe split up next week, and if we need to. So any questions about the lab then? Okay, well, what I want to do is start off, and I guess this might be a little bit introductory, but it never hurts to review this stuff. And I think one of the biggest questions that people have in here is about the course name. What's the course name?
Pedology.
And this is a real source of confusion to a lot of people. What does that mean? Anybody know? You guys sign up for a class and you don't know what it's about? Yeah.
Classification or the study of the classification.
Okay, that's part of it. And actually, let's just dissect this a little bit because, you know, I describe myself as a pedologist, and I would even go so far to say that, at least in one sense, I am a pedophile. Okay? Now, I say that because if you look at the root in this, everybody understands ology means study of, right? Okay, let's look at this root here, ped. This is actually a Greek root, P-E-D, and it means ground or earth, all right? Now, what's happened is when you hear the term pedophile or pediatrician or something like that, what does it make you think of? Kids, right? Young kids. And the reason for the confusion here is that there's a couple combining forms. I think it's P-A-I-D or P-A-E. And both of these mean, you know, child, boy, something like that. And the problem is these kind of got shortened just to ped. So you end up with ped really having two different meanings. So I want to forget about this one, and we're going to be thinking of in the context of the ground or the earth. So you guys can think of yourselves as studying pedology and hopefully pedophiles as well, but in this sense of the word. Now, those of you that had me in Soil 205, I think probably remember this. These two words, I know they're widely used, and I'm sure most of you have used them both, dirt and soil. Anybody remember what dirt means or where it comes from? Yeah, James.
Grit,
yeah, which is an Old Norse word meaning.
Ship.
All right, you said it, not me. Rhymes with drit. And soil, on the other hand, what would be a definition that somebody would give me for that?
Sand, silt, and clay.
Well, that could be part of it. You might remember something along the lines of a natural body on the land surface, resulting from the interaction of climate and organisms operating on parent material over a period of time, you know, that type of thing. And I'm not going to worry too much about a definition right now, but hopefully you've got a very different perspective than this business with just thinking of it as dirt, but you recognize that it's a fairly dynamic entity and that it's a result of interaction of a lot of different processes and factors. And that's really what we're going to focus on. Because if we come back to this term pedology, included under pedology is this area known as soil genesis. I know that sounds kind of biblical, but it's really nothing more than how soils form. And that's where we get into a lot of specific processes that cause soils to form or result in soil formation, and also the factors that influence the processes that take place and to what extent they take place. Also included in pedology is the whole business of soil classification. And as I mentioned last week, we're going to spend probably about half the semester on this with the classification system. The other parts of this are soil survey and mapping. And I'm sure some of you have had some experience with soil surveys where you actually look at these maps that indicate where different soil types are and the patterns that they occur on in the landscape. And we're not going to really do too much with mapping per se, but we will be using soil surveys somewhat in here. And then the other thing I would put on here is soil morphology. And morphology simply refers to what?
Structure.
Structure is a morphological characteristic, but morpho means morph. It just refers to what something looks like or the shape or the form that it has. And so when we talk about soil morphology, it includes a lot of properties that you can either observe in a soil or feel or determine when you examine a soil. And this is typically done in a field type setting. Obviously, there's a lot of things you can study in a laboratory, but morphology is really the more easily seen characteristics of a soil. So, and that's what we're going to start on here. I guess one other term that I'd like to mention, because you're going to see this a lot, and that is this one, pedon, P-E-D-O-N. Here's this root again. What is a pedon? Anybody know?
Like a piece of soil?
Piece of soil, yeah. That's we normally think of it as a three-dimensional body of soil. And even more specifically, when we talk about a pedon, the fact that it's three-dimensional, it's the smallest volume that can be considered a soil type, or I'm going to put in parentheses this word, soil series. Does everybody know what a soil series is? Okay. What how would you define a soil series? And don't say soil type, but
a soil element that's in an area that really, without going to the type, it comes back and it's reflected through certain regions?
Yeah, it's what we think of as a natural body on the landscape that has a very distinct and specified range and characteristics. And it can be a lot of different things. An example might be what we would call the Palouse silt loam. And that happens to be one of our extensive local soil series. You go out around here, and this is very typically the soil that you might find in this area. And if you look up a Palouse silt loam, you will find that it has a distinct and specified set of characteristics. And they're generally related to a lot of morphological properties, like how thick the A horizon is, and the color of the A horizon, the color of the B horizon, things of that sort. So back to this idea of a pedon then, what we're really talking about is this three-dimensional representation. Ooh. Hold on just a second. And I'm going to go ahead and put this figure up for you to take a look at. But this is just a figure out of the textbook that kind of shows a little bit of a landscape there. And this is a representation of what a pedon looks like. And so you can see it's three-dimensional, and often it's sort of a polygonal type shape up there at the surface. So in your book, they talk about the dimensions of this thing. And I think if you read it, it says that this area up here might be a meter or a couple meters at the lower end of the scale, and maybe up as much as 10 meters there or thereabouts. It kind of depends, because this pedon, we define it as being this body or three-dimensional body of soil that has the range, it has the full range and characteristics that we associate with a soil type or a soil series. So think of this as the Palouse silt loam, all right? And within this three-dimensional body, we've got the entire range and variation there. So it's not a real exact type of a concept, but I guess the reason that I bring it up is because when we get into talking about soil types and classification and characteristics and that sort of thing, it really is based on this concept of a pedon, this three-dimensional soil body. Okay, because that's really the unit that we study and the unit that we classify and analyze and do all these other things. And maybe another way to just give you an illustration of this. The second image here, this is a soil exposure. And you can see the rock here. Notice how that rock kind of goes up and down, or the soil depth changes as you go along a horizontal dimension. So if we want to extend this concept, this landscape here is probably one soil series, one soil type. And this is not the Palouse silt loam, but we'll just call it the alpha soil. Well, if we had to delineate a pedon, you know, probably the most noticeable range in variation in this soil is the depth down to bedrock, right? So if we think about extending this concept of a pedon to this, get back up here. Okay, so here's the deepest soil, there's the shallowest one. So that kind of reflects our range and characteristics, right? From our depth to bedrock. And we would consider that to be a pedon, at least in the horizontal dimension. There's another one, because we're going from the shallowest soil to the deepest expression of it, and so on. So you can imagine the landscape just made up of a whole bunch of these adjacent pedons together. And that's really what we're talking about when we consider a soil series, okay? Any questions about this? Yeah?
Can you use soil sequences or soil profiles as synonymous of soil series?
Well, you can, and I guess the main difference, if you think about a soil profile, a soil profile is simply a two-dimensional view of the soil. You'll see really the same things, but the difference is the PEDON's three-dimensional. And most of the pictures that I show you in here are going to be soil profiles, because it's just a two-dimensional look. And then this idea of a sequence, normally as you go down a hill slope, for example, you're going to probably get into different soil series. You know, they're going to change so much that you go from one soil type to another. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we get into the material a little bit more. But for right now, just kind of think of this PEDON as the basic unit of study, okay? Well, if you look at a soil, and those of you that came in the building this morning, you walk down the halls, there's lots of soils hanging on the walls, right? Representing different soil series. And I guess what I want to do is kind of focus on this idea of soil morphology and what are some of the easily observable or determined characteristics of a soil profile, okay? And in order to do that, let's just make a list here of what we would consider to be some of these important morphological features. So I'm going to put a list up here, and what I want you to do is just think of some morphological characteristics that would be fairly easily observed or described in a field setting.
Color.
Color. That's usually at the top of most people's list is the soil color. What else? Okay, texture. Be another one. And is that easily seen? No, that's something you actually have to feel a little bit. I was surprised that quiz that I gave you on last Thursday with the pictures. A lot of people had quite a bit to say about the texture based on looking at the pictures. And that's a pretty difficult thing to do, and I guess I would caution against it, all right? You really need to be able to feel it to say too much about texture. What would be other morphological properties?
Depth.
Okay, depth, very important one.
Structure.
Okay. And we're going to go over these in a little bit more detail. But we could, still some more we can list. Anybody in here in engineering? No. Well, one thing that a lot of folks that come at soils from an engineering perspective are concerned with is soil strength, how hard or how soft a soil might be. And what we call this is, fancy word, is rupture resistance. And it's really nothing more than an indicator of soil strength. You might also see this referred to as consistence. We get into some other morphological features. Can you think of any others that we don't have listed there?
Stability.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking stability is probably going to be related to this to some degree, and it's probably going to be related more to a site characteristic, for example, a really steep slope. And that's actually a good thing to note, but just in terms of not so much site characteristics, but just the inherent soil characteristics, I'm not sure that I would list that, but that's good thought. Any other inherent soil characteristics that could be observed, described?
Moisture?
Yeah, that's one that's normally, if somebody's doing a description, you're going to note whether it's a moist or a dry soil. But that's a property that is certainly one that an area like this is going to change a lot, you know, from by season. I'll add a couple here. How about roots? Plant roots. How about soil pores? You know, pores are kind of the plumbing and ventilation system in a soil, and it's something that is best, or you can really only describe it when you're looking at a soil in its natural setting. Once you dig it up and transport it back to the lab, it's pretty difficult to tell much about the roots and the pores. And I guess maybe I'll put one other thing on here. Just for lack of a better term, I'm going to call them miscellaneous features. And we'll go through what some of these might be. But at this point, if you went out and you observed a soil and did a description of all these properties I just listed there, that would constitute a very complete morphological description of the soil. And you guys are going to have opportunities to do this throughout the semester. But for right now, let's maybe go through these and talk a little bit about what each of these is. I mean, color is pretty obvious, but maybe something like rupture resistance is not. So we'll talk about what these things are and how we describe it, because there is a convention for how we describe these things, and then maybe even why does it matter, or what's significant about them. So I think what I want to do, I'll go back to the images here. And we should get somebody to volunteer to hold this. Okay, so the first thing that I'm going to mention in terms of these morphological properties, let's talk about color. And can anybody tell me why is color significant, or why would that be something that you would want to describe?
The microbial health could be an indicator of the color.
What's that?
Microbial health.
It could tell you something about microbial health. Well, I don't know so much about health, but maybe the type. Even more generally.
Soil chemistry, how much like iron and like minerals and stuff?
Yeah, it tells you an awful lot about the chemical environment. And we think about things like red soil colors, brown, yellow. What do those indicate?
Oxidation.
Well, oxidation, and more specifically the presence of iron oxides, right? And how about something like... how about dark colors like black or really dark brown? What do those usually indicate?
Organic.
Yeah, organic material. How about white colors? What might those indicate? Okay, something that's leached out or eluviated. What else could white?
Salts.
Okay, salts, soluble salts, lime, calcium carbonate, all good examples. Unweathered volcanic ash often looks white or very light gray color. A lot of possibilities there. How about gley soil colors, G-L-E-Y? Anybody remember what those are?
Anaerobic conditions.
Yeah, it's a dull gray color that indicates anaerobic conditions or reducing conditions. So that would certainly be an important thing. And let me just, I'll run through some examples of these things. But first of all, if we look at what we would consider oxidizing colors. These are reds, yellows, medium brown colors like you would see in the subsoils here. And if you see those things, you know that the soil is in an oxidized condition. It's a well aerated soil, and that oxygen is not going to be a limiting factor in any way. And these colors, the reds, yellows, and browns, as I said, are due to the presence of different types of iron oxides. Some are red, some are brown, just depending on the differences in their structure. The gley colors, dull gray, sometimes even bluish or greenish tint, these are indicative of a waterlogged soil, one where oxygen is limiting. And in fact, if you look at this profile here, you can see the the subsoil with this dull gray coloration, and that's actually water down there at the bottom of the pit. So this is something, if you go out in the field and you look at a soil, you see the subsoil, and it's not red or yellow or that nice brown color, it's something like this instead, that should be a red flag that this is a wet soil, even if you don't see the water table, and one that's going to have a lot of limitations for most uses. So just as a comparison, which of those soils would be better suited for a septic tank drain field or a landfill or any something along those lines? Left or right?
Right.
Yeah, the one on the right, you think that's a very well-drained, what we would call a well-drained soil, and the one on the left is what we would term a poorly drained soil because of those clay colors, and of course the water down at the bottom of the base of that is a giveaway as well. But oftentimes around here, you might not see water. If you're out in the summertime when it's dry, you're not going to have that water table there, but you still will see the coloration, and that's why it's so important. And I mentioned the situation around here where we have very wet conditions during the winter and spring, and then very dry conditions during the summer. And it's not uncommon that you end up with a soil that has what we refer to as a mottled color pattern. And you notice this right here, where you've got the oxidized reddish colors intermixed in this pattern with the gray, or these what we're calling the clay colors. And so what would something like that indicate if you saw that in a soil horizon? Yeah, that you have this alternating, oxidizing, and reducing types of conditions. And that's typically what we might see more of around here because of the fact that it's wet and then very dry, depending on the time of the year. And here's another example of the same thing, but you notice the difference in the modeling patterns here. The one on the lower right has much more of the gray coloration, and this one up here, the upper left, has more of the reddish brown colors to it. So you can kind of use that as a relative indicator of how much of the time is the soil reduced, how much of the time is the soil oxidized. And I think going by that, I'd say the one on the lower right hand corner would be the wetter of the soils, or waterlogged more of the time. We were talking about white coloration and mentioned calcium carbonate, or somebody said lime. Here's a couple of examples of soil profiles that have calcium carbonate in them, and you can see the whitish color. And generally speaking, if you are in an arid or somewhat arid environment, semi-arid to arid, and you see white material in the subsoil, most of the time it's going to represent calcium carbonate. And it may be a situation like the profile on the left, where the calcium carbonate is pretty much disseminated throughout the entire horizon. Or the example on the right here, it's just these very distinct white nodules or areas that you see down there in the subsoil. Either way, it's still calcium carbonate. Very, very common component of soils from arid and semi-arid regions in the world. Somebody mentioned the white being soluble salts. This is an example of that. Here it shows up as a surface crust in that soil profile. And the looks a lot like calcium carbonate. Can anybody tell me how you would tell the difference between calcium carbonate and soluble salts if you're out in the field?
Taste it.
You could taste it, sure, and the salts are going to taste salty. Carbonate, not so much. But yeah, Dan, you had a...
The hydrochloric acid, it'll fizz on the calcium carbonate.
Yeah, and one of the things that soil scientists carry around with them when they're doing morphological descriptions is a little bottle of dilute hydrochloric acid, because if you put that on calcium carbonate, you get this effervescence or fizzing, and if you put it on soluble salts, generally it's just going to dissolve the salts away, but you won't see the effervescence. Now you can run into problems if you have both calcium carbonate and soluble salts, but In general, it's a pretty good way to tell them apart. Why would we be concerned about soluble salts? Well, what's the main effect of those, at least from a plant's perspective? Yeah, really it lowers production because soluble salts, I guess I think of it as being a detriment to water uptake. So even though you have a moist soil, if it's high salinity, plants aren't going to be able to extract the water. And sometimes you can get so many soluble salts that they can actually be toxic to certain plants. Here's another type of white material that you're not going to find everywhere, but certainly in parts of the Pacific Northwest. You see this white layer running through here? And that's simply weathered or unweathered volcanic ash. And what happened here, it got buried pretty quickly, so it's not really weathering. This is from the eruption of Mount Mazama 7,000 years ago, and it's in a dry area. It hasn't weathered much, so you get this very distinct marker layer of volcanic ash. And in fact, if some of you might remember Mount St. Helens erupting 1980, and if you go up on Moscow Mountain and dig around a little bit, you can find this little layer of gray, whitish volcanic ash up on the surface in places under the forest litter layer. What is an eluvial layer? What's this word right here, E-L-U-V-I-A-L? What does that refer to? Yeah, the removal of or the leaching of. So we talk about a white or very light colored horizon, like you see here, and that is an eluvial layer, or one in which the pigmenting agents have been lost. So the pigmenting agents would be things like iron oxides, clays, sometimes humus, and for various reasons, usually it's high precipitation, a lot of water moving down through the soil, these things get picked up and transported further down. And you end up with the material just appearing white because you don't have any of these pigmenting agents there. And that's what you're seeing there. This happens to be the state soil for Florida. And it's probably one of the most impressive e-horizons I've ever seen, in one of these eluvial layers. This is in inches, so this is almost 4 feet down here at the bottom. You can see a couple feet of really light colored material. So how do we describe soil color? Well, it turns out that just using a verbal description, well, it's white or it's gray or it's brown, really isn't very good. So we use something known as Munsell notation, or these Munsell color charts. And I think most of you have probably seen these before and used them a little bit. We'll have them in lab this week so you can practice with them if you haven't. But here's the way it works. This is a page out of the Munsell book, and you'll notice that it's got all of these chips on it. They look like the kind of chips you get at a paint store if you're trying to select a color of paint. And there's some numbers up here. You notice the upper right-hand corner, it says 10YR, and then on the left-hand axis going up, it says value, and there's 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and hold it down a little bit. Right there at the bottom, it says chroma going across from left to right, and you can see the numbers there. So what we can do is take a sample of soil, and we can match it up with the closest color chip, and then use this Munsell notation to describe that color. So here's how it would work. We start off, this would be an example of a Munsell notation, something like 10YR, 5-3, and it would represent this color chip right there. So the first part of the 10YR is what we call the hue, and that's really nothing more than the portion of the color spectrum that we're dealing with. I think of it as whether it's red or yellow or brown or blue, green, whatever the case may be. And we read the hue from the upper right-hand corner. The next part of it, the 5, refers to what we call the color value, and that is simply the lightness or the darkness. And you notice, here's the color value, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. As we go up those rows, what's happening as we go from a color value of 2 to a color value of 8? Soil's getting lighter, right? So the lower the color value, the darker the soil, the higher the color value, the lighter it is. And then the chroma is going to be the third part of it. And chroma is a little bit harder to define. People think of it as the intensity or brightness of a color. So if you look at these columns here, there's a chroma of 1, 2, 3, and so on. I guess you could say that the brown colors are getting more intense or brighter as you go from left to right. And so this color chip right here, we end up with a Munsell notation of 10YR53, okay? And that corresponds to light brownish color or something like that. But if you think about it, if you describe the color of the soil as brown, well, there's a lot of variation in that, and some people have partial color blindness and all that. So this is just a standardized way of describing soil color that everybody can use and agree on. Yeah.
You consider this color with a dry sample or wet sample?
Okay, that's a very good question. The color, do you do it with a dry or a wet sample? And the answer is you do it with both, or ideally you do it with both, because a soil color is going to change with moisture content. And you can see this in lab on Thursday, but as you moisten up a soil, the color value tends to decrease, or the soil gets darker. And I can't think of a single exception. Sometimes the hue changes, sometimes the chroma might change, but the color value will always change as a function of water content or moisture content. And as we're going to see later in the semester, when you get into classification in soil taxonomy, there's actually certain taxonomic groupings that are defined, at least partially, on the basis of color, and again, using the Munsell notation. All right, let's talk a little bit about texture. Hopefully this is review. This is the table. It's out of your book. I didn't write down the table number on here, but it's just showing particle size classes, and what we're going to be using is the one that the USDA uses. And so you've got clay particles, silt, sand, and I think from intro soils you probably remember the size limits on those. Clay is anything smaller than 0.002 millimeters. Silt goes from 0.002 up to 0.05 millimeters. And then sand is actually, you can see it's between 0.05 millimeters in diameter going up to a maximum diameter of 2 millimeters. And it's subdivided into very fine, fine, medium, coarse, and very coarse sands as well. Now, a couple things to make a note of. One, this USDA system is a little bit different than this international system. It's a little bit different than this unified system, and then it's a little bit different than what's called this AASHTO system, which is the American Association of State Highway Transportation Officials or something like that. It's more of an engineering thing. But so if you say clay, well, it's often probably good to, you might mention in the USDA system, because it's going to be different than some of these others. But the other part about this is that what do we do with stuff that's bigger than 2 millimeters, since that's the upper limit of sand? Well, we actually have names for what we're going to call rock fragments. You see the term gravel there? Everybody's used the term gravel. Well, it has very specific size ranges here, from 2 millimeters up to 76 millimeters. And they split it into fine, medium, coarse gravel. I wouldn't worry about that. But it's essentially everything from 2 millimeters up to 3 inches in diameter. That would qualify as gravel. And then you get into what are known as cobbles, and you can see the size range there, 76 up to 250 millimeters. So that would be 3 inches up to about 10 inches in diameter. So something like that. You've seen maybe seen a cobblestone street. Well, that's the terminology. Then you get into stones, and the stones would be from 10 inches up to 24 inches in diameter. And then finally, boulders, which are going to be greater than 24 inches in diameter. So that's the range of particle sizes. And I think in intro soils, you probably learned about texture, being the percentages of sand, silt, and clay. So take just a minute to refresh your memory. Does this look familiar, the textural triangle? So you can plot out the percent sand, silt, and clay. They're going to add up to 100. And what you do is you plot this out, and you end up with within one of 12 textural classes. Clays, clay loams, so on, silt loams, silty clay loams. And then this is the way that we typically describe soil texture, rather than saying, oh, this sample is 45% sand, 27% silt, and so on. That's kind of cumbersome. So what we do is group the various particle size distributions into these textural classes, with the idea being that everything that falls within the clay loam range is going to behave pretty similarly in terms of the hydrology and, you know, things like water holding capacity and so on. So these are the 12 textural classes. And again, here's just to test your understanding of this. Let's say a soil has 25% sand, 23% clay, 52% silt. What would the textural class be? Anybody try and figure that out? 25% sand, 23% clay, 52% silt. Where does that put it on that textural triangle?
Silt loam.
Silt loam, yeah. So all you have to do is, here's the 25% sand. So there's zero sand, 25, that line going up there. And then if we look at the clay content, 23%. Here's 0% clay, 10, 20, the horizontal lines. So there's our 23% clay. And all we need is that point of intersection. When you've got two out of the 3 points, the third one's fixed, right? We'll put it on here anyway. And there's the 52% silt. Zero at the top, 10, 20, 30, 40. 50, so 52, and you can see that point of intersection. So we have a silt loam textural class. And that would be a very typical textural class for the soils in this region. So that's the way the textural triangle works. And as I mentioned, it's difficult to look at a soil and estimate texture, with a couple of exceptions. What could you tell me about the texture of that soil?
Clay.
It's probably got a lot of clay in it, as evidenced by the big cracks. This happens to be a dry soil. Now this next one, can you tell me anything about the texture of that? Looks kind of sandy, and if you think about some of the larger, coarse, very coarse sand grains, they're getting up to be sizable enough that you can easily observe them without any sort of magnification. So it wouldn't be difficult to say, yeah, that's pretty sandy. But in most cases, you've got to feel it in order to make that kind of call. And what we do in the laboratory is a detailed particle size analysis. You probably did it in a intro soils lab, where you actually measure the amount of sand, silt, and clay in a sample based on how quickly they fall down through this column. The sand goes, because it's bigger, it falls faster. The clays stay in suspension for a really long time. But this, has anyone ever done this or paid to have it done? Well, if you've done it, you know that it gets to be pretty tedious, and it can take a while, because how long does it take for silt to settle out in these things? Yeah, it takes a long time. It might be 7 or 8 hours or something like that. And if you send a sample off to a lab, they'll probably charge you about $30, $40 to do something like this. So one thing that you cannot underestimate the value of is being able to do what we call hand texturing. And I think most of you have done this at one time or another. And all you're doing is taking a sample, you moisten it up, you work it back and forth in your hand, and then you look at things, properties like how gritty is it, because gritty is an indicator of sand. Notice how this one is kind of being formed into what we would call a ribbon, and it's holding its weight or supporting its weight, and that's an indicator of how much clay is present in the sample. So if you can estimate sand and clay percentages, then you can pretty much figure out where on that textural triangle a sample goes. We're going to spend a lot of time doing this in here over the course of the semester. There'll be samples every week pretty much from now till the end of the semester. And I think if you work at these, even if you haven't done it before, by the time May rolls around, you're going to be pretty good at taking a sample and at least estimating a textural class and maybe even percent clay based on the way that it feels. Okay, one last thing about texture, and it gets back to this idea of the rock fragments, okay? This is a soil profile from one of the dominant soils down in the McCall area. In fact, it's called the McCall series, aptly named, and it's formed in glacial till. We'll talk a little bit more about glacial till, but if I ask you, what's the textural class of that soil? Well, what you'd probably do in the field, and let's just pick, this scale here is in increments of 10 centimeters, okay? So this would be half a meter. If we got a sample there and we determined the percent sand, silt, and clay in that particular sample, let's just arbitrarily say we come up with a loam textural class, all right? So more or less an equal influence of sand, silt, and clay particles. Well, if I turned around and told a client, maybe somebody that's hired me to do a soil description, that their soil is a loam, would I be lying to them? Not exactly, but would I really be giving them the information that is most important? Probably not, because this thing is loaded with rock fragments. So what do? We somehow have to marry this idea of the textural class, which is simply relative proportions of sand, silt, and clay, with this idea of rock fragments. So we can get the textural class, but then we can use what are known as rock fragment modifiers. And what we have to do is make a visual estimate of how many rocks or the rock fragments present in that profile. And typically we use charts like this. And I think all of you have maybe done something like this if you're trying to estimate percent plant cover or canopy cover, and it's a common way of doing it. It's about the best we have, because obviously you're not going to be able to sieve through materials like we've got in that soil profile. So looking at those, what would you estimate the rock fragment content would be?
40%.
Yeah, maybe somewhere around 40%. The rule of thumb on making these types of estimates is that 95% of the folks that do this tend to overestimate unless they've been doing it for a long time. So maybe if you come up with an estimate and you cut it back a little bit, you might be closer. But I'd say 40 is a reasonable estimate. And what we would end up doing is calling this particular soil dry. What we're doing is describing the particle size distribution. We end up calling it a very stony loam. And therefore, we get the idea that it's a loam textural class, but the idea that it's very stony, meaning that it's got a pretty high percentage of rock fragments or stones in it. And I think you'll agree that's a more apt description of what's there. Okay, I gotta stop, and we'll pick this up on Thursday. And as I said, Thursday in lab, you'll get a chance to try your hand at some of this.